my guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 417. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. I really am fantastic. I'm always excited when we get to have AG on the show, and I'm always excited to do the show with you. So I'm great. How are you, man?
I'm good. Quick note on AG being on the show. Not really sure if we can not have the explicit tag for this one. So
it's always a challenge to edit her. I love her.
If you're somebody who downloads every episode of Opening Arguments and decides to put it on for your, I don't know, 6-7 year old kids, you know, maybe this one be careful with, I guess.
We'll give you a content warning. You could definitely listen to the A segment in which I explain what the Hatch Act is and how it applies. But unmasking AG, you'll probably want to wait till the kids
go to bed. Unmasked and uncensored, apparently. So that's fun. So this episode, explicit warning, I suppose. And that'll fix a lot of editing problems for me. You'll see. It's like, how do we creatively keep the content of this while also, and it's tough. So also, we wanted to, you know, take a chance here. I don't think we've mentioned it on primetime very much, that I've been doing the shows and getting them out, especially the one you're hearing right now. I get this out for patrons a whole day early, and that's not just like a every once in a while thing. This is now for however many months this has been. Gosh, almost 2 full months now. The Tuesday show, which is technically like, you know, Tuesday at 12:01 a.m. Eastern time, has been coming out a full day ahead of that, you know, so that would be Monday at 12:01 a.m. Eastern time. And so that's another patron perk. And as you saw last week, whenever there's a technical glitch, somehow the patrons still get the show. So that's another reason. But I would just wanted to throw that out there because I keep meaning to say that we're doing that. And that's every single Tuesday show comes out a full day early for patrons, and there are all kinds of other good reasons to be a patron as well, like, for example, submitting questions to the live Q&A that is just happened. So
that is yesterday.
I was gonna say tomorrow, but I got my days mixed up. So that was a ton of fun, everybody, and so join the Patreon.
Thomas, be honest, did you engineer the technical difficulties just to make people want to go be patrons?
No, sometimes RSS feeds do a thing where they decide they cannot physically be updated. Like, even though I did it and like fixed the episode, published, the RSS feed was like, I'm not moving. I will not budge for a full 10 hours. And nothing I did mattered. And then just weirdly, like 10 hours later, it just updated. I don't know. Sorry. It's gremlins or something.
RSS updating is like a tasty brand of cupcakes as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I have zero input knowledge or understanding. Yeah. It just goes into a magic box and comes out a series of tubes. So that's my okay boomer moment of the show.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
So you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia, to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. Well, with that said, again, you can enjoy that patreon.com/law, all those perks. But now, let's get to our episode, which is all about the worthless piece of paper that doesn't do anything except possibly harass people out of their jobs occasionally when they're a certain side of things. Anyway, the Hatch Act. Andrew, break down the Hatch Act for us.
Yeah. So as we're going to find out, look, the Hatch Act is not this, you know, semicolon lost to history that is never enforced. It is a robust, vigorously enforced, frequently debated law, and it applies to everybody except Donald Trump's friends. And we're going to explain why. These questions have come up because of last week's Republican, can I convey sarcasm quotes on the air, but convention, that was interesting to watch. And so a number of people noted things that seemed to, and spoiler alert, violate the law. And we're going to explain exactly what that law is, how it violates it, and why, in this case, if you're on the Negatron side of, and it doesn't matter, specifically why it doesn't matter, because I think that it's important, you know, look, our next president has an awful lot of items on his to-do list, but understanding what the Hatch Act does and doesn't do helps us pave the way for understanding what kind of legislation we might want to pass, right? So what is the Hatch Act? The Hatch Act is an 81-year-old law, which makes it 4 years younger than Orrin Hatch, which we wondered about in our last episode, that is designed to prohibit public employees, principally employees of the executive branch, from engaging in political activity while they're doing their job. Okay. This was passed in 1939, and you might be thinking, 1939, what's going on? Right? Franklin Delano Roosevelt greatly expanding the size of the federal government, right? That's the New Deal. And the concern from the political opposition was that as you are expanding the government and doing good things for people in the midst of a Great Depression, that incumbents would be able to use to leverage the power of that larger government into advantages for their reelection, right? And if you think about that, we've kind of walked this tightrope ever since, right? Why does Donald Trump want his name as a signature on all of the stimulus checks? That's obvious, right? Incumbents want to take credit for the things that they've done that they think are popular, and you can anticipate and expect that. But what you don't want to take is somebody who is doing the job of the business of making government run and turn them into a mouthpiece for the administration, right? And you don't want to do that for a lot of reasons, right? There are already a lot of advantages to being an incumbent. We didn't need more. That was the principal motivation for the passage of the Hatch Act in 1939, right? It was a bulwark against a very incumbent president. But also, as the size of government expands, you want to preserve the ability for people to do their jobs, whether they agree with the administration or not, right? And we're going to have AG on in the next segment, and that's a perfect illustration, right? She was a high-level government employee, continued to do her job, which is securing funding for the Veterans Administration's TRICARE health program, right? You want her to do her job helping veterans, whether Donald Trump is president or not, right? So those are the purposes behind the Hatch Act. Here's how those purposes got put into practice. And this is 5 U.S.C. section 7324. That describes what you can't do. And as you listen, it's a pretty specific list, right? It says an employee may not engage in political activity, one, while the employee is on duty, two, in any room or building occupied in the discharge of official duties by an individual employed or holding office in the government of the United States or any agency or instrumentality thereof. And side note, you know, you can really see the 1939 in this law, right? Like how this works in the age of emails and Zoom conferences, right? Is not clear. Three, while wearing a uniform or official insignia, identifying the office or position of the employee. And again, another little sidebar there, you may have seen and noticed that members of the military do not wear their military dress while speaking in a political capacity. That is not under the Hatch Act. That is actually under a separate statute, 10 U.S.C. section 973B. I didn't know that until I started researching
this
episode.
But is that another thing that Trump cronies have ignored?
Yes.
Okay.
973B says that military officers cannot run for political office while holding their office. Section 593 says that they cannot interfere with elections, and that is interpreted broadly. And so that's why, generally speaking, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff does not come out in dress uniform when they are speaking in a political capacity. So separate from, but adjacent to the Hatch Act, you don't speak in your official capacity, identifying the office or position of the employee when you're engaging in political activity. Or four, using any vehicle owned or leased by the government of the United States or any agency or instrumentality thereof. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the exceptions, but that's the law, right? It's you can't do those four things. And you probably noticed a big question mark, right? And that is the law doesn't define what political activity is.
Hmm.
And that's because it's 1939 and everyone was just like, eh. As it turns out, the Office of Personnel Management has promulgated regulations that define political activity as, quote, an activity directed towards the success or failure of a political party, candidate for partisan political office, or partisan political group. That means that advocacy for a particular political issue, and the example that is given in the regulations themselves, for example, an anti-war platform, right, that is not directed towards the success or failure of a political party, candidate, or group is not considered political activity.
Hmm. That's an interesting distinction, though. It feels like any issue like abortion or something.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
very clearly.
Where it clearly aligns with the political parties. Yeah. That ambiguity is one of sort of the many legal questions that surround the Hatch Act. And I would also add, while we're doing it to maybe it shouldn't be this way, but for most of the country's history, an activity that would have fallen within that category that would be considered nonpartisan would be efforts to convince people to vote. Because again, up until about 1990, the Republican Party was actually interested in having people vote. Now that is a political issue, but historically that was something where, you know, you would say, yeah, it's perfectly reasonable to have the chairman of the FEC come out and say, hey, it's every American's duty to get out and vote if you can. Right. And you used to run, even Republican administrations would run PSAs like that were non-political, didn't run afoul of the Hatch Act, even though voting is a political activity, right, in the broader sense of the word, doesn't count as political activity for purposes of the Hatch Act. In addition to the specific prohibitions under 7324, there is the immediately preceding section, 7323, lists the kinds of things that you can do if you're a federal employee, right? It says you have the right to vote as you choose and to express your opinion on political subjects and candidates. And you might be thinking, well, that seems like that's directly in, right? How can you express your opinion on political subjects and candidates and not engage in political activity while you're on duty, right? And so in the litigation, you have things like what is called the water cooler rule, right?
Ah.
And And it means exactly what I like. The next generation, like, you know, our Xennials coming up are going to be like, what the hell's a water cooler, right? Like, everybody works remotely.
Yeah.
you and I still remember offices and water coolers. Mm-hmm. But that was the idea, right? Was, yeah, look, you're not going to get kicked out for violating the Hatch Act that, you know, you go over to the water cooler and you're like, oh, man, could you believe the RNC last night?
Yeah, I wonder if some of these cronies should, like, have a water cooler with them on stage at the RNC to be like, look, this is just water cooler talk. It's under that rule.
Could be. I mean, look, the hypocrisy is palpable when, and if you have an Uncle Frank who is, you know, overly defensive on this matter, just mention the names Peter Strzok and Lisa Page to him, right? Like, discovering a handful of text messages between FBI agents that they did not support Donald Trump was enough to create an entire QAnon level conspiracy of the deep state to bring them down. But, you know, violating the Hatch Act on national television, no big deal. Anyway, the reason for all of that is kind of what you'd think, right? Which is, as you are restricting, arguably, the freedom of speech to engage in political expression, the framers of the Hatch Act in 1939 wanted to make sure that the act was constitutional. Right? That it didn't violate the First Amendment rights of people just because they worked for the government. And I will tell you again, cutting to the punchline, if you have somebody in your timeline who is saying that the Hatch Act is unconstitutional because it violates freedom of speech, that's not true. We have a case. It is 47 years old. United States Civil Service Commission versus National Association of Letter Carriers, 413 U.S. 548 from 1973, that says the Hatch Act is not unconstitutional, does not violate the First Amendment, is not overly vague, does not chill and suppress permissible free speech. So in other words, it's perfectly fine to restrict, to say, hey, if you're going to work for the executive branch, you should maintain a separation between your political activities and endorsing those activities as part of your job. I mentioned that nobody that's close to Trump has ever paid any penalties under the Hatch Act. That's because of how the Hatch Act is enforced. And that comes, we just said 7324 is where the prohibitions come from. 7326, this 5 USC 7326, are the penalties for violating the Hatch Act. And they are, the default position is removal from government office, right? Being Which fired.
I would totally take that.
Yeah.
As a consequence. You're going to get to why there's just, there are no consequences eventually?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Here's what happens. Back in 1939, we thought it made perfect sense to have the Office of Special Counsel, another executive branch agency, review and investigate potential Hatch Act violations, and then present complaints regarding those violations to the Merit Systems Protection Board. And then the Merit Systems Protection Board would be an outside quasi-judicial agency. It would adjudicate the case, right? Mm. If you are accused of violating the Hatch Act, you appear before the MSPB. You have a right to have a lawyer present. It's treated like a trial. They determine whether you violated it or not, and if so, what your penalties are, again, with the default penalty of removal. But that can go up, right? You can be removed and debarred, that is, prohibited from serving in future federal employment. Again, you could be debarred for up to 5 years. Or you could be reprimanded. You could be reduced in grade. You can get a civil penalty not to exceed $1,000, right? Or any combination of those things. But again, the default is you violate the Hatch Act and you're fired. However, with high-level executive employees under Donald Trump, the OSC has not been referring these cases to the MSPB, but has instead been referring them to the Office of the President of the United States.
That seems like a conflict, perhaps.
Kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah. And by the way, because it's an administrative hearing, the MSPB, you then... you appear before them, an administrative law judge rules, and then you can appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. So you get eventually the right to be heard in court as a result of this process. Now, again, that hearing, like any administrative hearing, is going to be highly deferential to the administrative findings below. So, you know, it's a big deal what the MSPB does. It's a big deal how the OSC frames the violation. And the OSC has been doing its job. Kellyanne Conway, for example, has violated the Hatch Act more than 60 times, according to our friends over at Crew. Unfortunately, the OSC has been instructed to present those complaints not to the Merit Systems Protection Board, but to the White House, which then has done nothing. And so so Crew sued the Office of Special Counsel, and in a decision that came out a little over 3 weeks ago, I have already uploaded it to our, I had to download it off of Lexis and upload it to the Opening Arguments website. So I did. You can read it. The United States District Court for the District of Columbia, this is Judge Boasberg, concedes that Kellyanne Conway has violated, has, quote, repeatedly violated the Hatch Act, but held that Crew lacked standing to be able to claim an injury redressable by law under the Hatch Act, that they did not have particularized interests separate from the public at large in ensuring that Kellyanne Conway does her job. And so I will tell you, it's weird to see this written in a U.S. District Court opinion, but here's the conclusion. So after kicking out the lawsuit on standing grounds, the U.S. District Court says, while the court understands plaintiff's frustration that Conway is continuing to violate the Hatch Act with seeming impunity, it must hew to its jurisdictional borders. Those do not permit its intrusion here.
Sorry, what? How?
Because the Hatch Act was not meant to provide individual plaintiffs with a private right of action to enforce the Hatch Act. And so I read the conclusion, but I could say the judge front-loaded his conclusion, right? Before the discussion says, as the court agrees with the former argument, right? That is that Crew lacks standing. It need not reach the latter. That is that it fails to state a claim. Quote, such a ruling means the Crew must seek other avenues to hold Conway accountable for her misdeeds, end of quote. So again, it is not a matter of opinion by a liberal lawyer on a liberal podcast that Kellyanne Conway has repeatedly violated the Hatch Act. It is the opinion of the Office of Special Counsel delivered to the desk of President Donald Trump, and the opinion of a sitting judge of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Kellyanne Conway has repeatedly, more than 60 occasions, used her office inappropriately to directly endorse and advance the interests of the president of the United States. But the president does not care. Not only does the president not care about Kellyanne Conway, he did not care that Melania Trump delivered her remarks from the White House Rose Garden. And again, it's not clear that I should add the Hatch Act by definition does not apply to the president or vice president and shouldn't, right? Like we should think the president is free to campaign for his own reelection, right?
Yeah. Cause you're not taking off your president hat, which yeah. I can't believe there's actually a president hat. Sorry, that was it like a joke. Like, oh yeah, your president hat. And I realized there's actually a fucking president hat. I'm glad this is an explicit show since I'm already cat's out of the bag on that one. He has a hat that he wears anyway. Sorry.
but the harm. So in other words, the president delivering his speech from the Oval Office while the reason that no other sitting president has ever done that is not that the president can't do it. It is, in order to deliver that speech, you now have all of the executive branch employees yeah. in the Oval Office who are directly contributing to the president's reelection, right? Right. The cameramen that are sitting, like they are engaging in working hours in an activity that is 100% partisan political activity, to wit, the reelection of President Donald Trump. And they're forced to do it.
This is interesting, though. So theoretically, like, I guess you're saying this would never be done before because you have a convention that's at a location.
Yep.
And every, you know, while the president and vice president might be immune from this or whatever, which, you know, makes sense, the other people at the convention wouldn't be, you wouldn't want to have the convention at the White House. But like, I guess in the times of COVID, you could theoretically make this work in an ethical way, or even having, well, I guess when you say the cameraman, I mean, it's not as though they're having White House employees be cameramen, right? I mean, I'm sure they can hire outside people. So there would be a way, theoretically, to make this
there
work.
Would be a way that this administration has not used, right?
Of course,
And we should add, right, going beyond the president and vice president, right, Mike Pompeo was on an official diplomatic trip to the Middle East. He appeared in his capacity as Secretary of State from Israel to address the convention.
Blatantly right? illegal, right?
It is a 100% a violation of the
Party Hatch of Law and Order. Everybody. Party
no doubt. Order. No doubt whatsoever. There is no argument whatsoever. And the only arguments that Trump supporters are going to make is, come on, who the hell cares?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're about to have on an executive branch employee. If you're not Donald Trump and you're not Donald Trump's inner circle of cronies, you absolutely do care about this law.
Ooh, good setup for bringing on AG. All right, let's get on over right, to
well,
our guest
I'm ready,
for today.
I'm ready when AG, you are, fellas.
And we are joined by AG, of course, from Mueller. She wrote in the Daily Beans, returning back to the show for the umpteenth time. How's it going, AG?
It's going well this week. I'm on a little bit of a vacation, so that means I only work about 8 hours a day, so it's going good.
Yeah, I imagine vacations are the same for Andrew. I think that's that means he only reads like 40 court documents a day.
I have done Daily Beans while on my vacation, so I appreciate the return courtesy. This is great.
Yeah, of course. No problem.
As you know, we are breaking down a deep dive on the Hatch Act because, you know, we just had this North Korean Republican National Convention where every other speaker was named Trump. And, you know, Melania Trump gave her speech from the Rose Garden. Donald Trump gave it from the Oval Office. So on, I can do, you know, the boring, this is what the law says. But you have firsthand experience with the Hatch Act under Donald Trump. So I thought I'd ask you about that story.
Oh, yeah. Me and the Hatch Act, we go way back. So yeah, as you know, in December of 2017, the week that the Flynn and Manafort, or excuse me, was it Manafort and Gates? Manafort and Gates indictments dropped. We started our first episode of Mueller, She Wrote. And I was working full time for the federal government as the health system specialist for the Department of Veterans Affairs in the West Region, as the liaison embedded in the Department of Defense, providing oversight for the TRICARE contract because the VA is a network provider. My job was to go out and collect the money from the DOD owed to the VA, and I recouped anywhere from 80 to 150 million a year for veterans.
Nice work.
Thank you. And so I started a podcast where I was pretty much basically saying that Trump should be in prison. And since he was running for office, as we know, he filed the paperwork to run for president in 2020. He filed it on Inauguration Day 2017.
Yeah.
And so he's always been running for office since he took the oath. Of course, after criticizing Obama for filing his paperwork a few months early. Now, if I had come out and said, my name is Allison Gill, I work for Department of Veterans Affairs, I'm really high up, I've got a really good inside view here, and Trump should be in prison, that would be a violation of the Hatch Act if anyone's playing along. Because you can't campaign for or against a political candidate, you can't fundraise for or a political candidate while working for the executive branch of the government. And me being of ethical, sound mind, did not want to violate the Hatch Act. So I hired some lawyers, some experts at the Hatch Act, and I said, what do I need to do to make sure that I am not running afoul of the Hatch Act or any other ethical concerns or, you know, policy or anything like that? And they gave me a long list of things not to do and what to do, and followed those to the T. That's why I go by AG, as a matter of fact. I'm out now. My name's Allison Gill. Everyone, follow me on Twitter, at Allison Gill. Hi. Because I've been removed from my position, but not for violating the Hatch Act, though they tried their damnedest. But in any case, I did obsessive research on the Hatch Act and didn't want to make any money off of my government position for me personally. I didn't want to, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of different ethical concerns that you have to, that are kind of subsumed into the Hatch Act. And I, being a, you know, a career professional with the federal government, we're generally an ethical group of people, usually.
So we've talked a little bit about the specific subsections of the law. You identify yourself as a federal government employee instead of anonymously as AG. But you make it clear that the podcast is produced in your spare time. Sorry, I almost said that sentence without laughing. But, you know, not on government time, right? Not with the assistance or using any federal funds.
Yeah, that would have been awkward if you're like in your office during recording and then people are like asking you for stuff. Like, hey, here's this $40 million check you asked for. Hey, what? Oh, you? What's that microphone?
Are you talking to Andrew McCabe? What's happening?
But yeah, so, but no, suppose, I mean, you kind of went down and ticked off all the boxes and says, okay, you know, I'm not on duty. I'm not on government premises. I'm not using government equipment. I'm not using or accepting government money in any way. If, in the language of the statute, quote, all the costs associated with that political activity are not paid for by money derived from the Treasury of the United States. What was the concern that still might not be enough?
In my mind, the concern was what I was talking about.
Yeah.
I figured we would just be in our kitchen doing 80 downloads a week. And when we, you know, right around the time we were nominated for the Webby, which we ended up winning the People's Choice, and we were
That was very smooth, by the way. I like that. Keep going.
Thank you. And we were getting a quarter of a million downloads per episode. We were getting press coverage in the Washington Post and the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. I was like, uh-oh, people are going to know. And, but I, you know, I made sure, like you said, that I was not violating the Hatch Act in any way and even taking it steps further. Like, I could actually have used my real name. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the question I was hinting at. But please, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I could have used my real name, but I, you know, as long as you don't use your title or like you said, any money from the Treasury to fund your own personal little anti-Trump thing, you should be good. Though I will say, right around that time, when we were at the peak of Mueller, she wrote, we got a memo, a Hatch Act executive order update from Donald Trump. And he said, this extends now to social media. And it's not just that you can't campaign for or against a political candidate for office, elected office. You can't say anything bad about Trump specifically. So I was like, And I swear to God, I was like, is this because of me? Like, I really honestly felt like. So then we modified our Twitter activity. I had somebody else tweet on behalf if there were any tweets that were going to go out. And we never tweeted any fundraising because you're not allowed to do that at all. Mm-hmm. Sent out, I even have the email I sent out to the staff, like, here's what you can and can't do, here's when you can do it and when you can't do it. And so we had to make little modifications when this, with the, you know, this Trump memo came out. And I was like, okay, you know, Donald Trump, you're already covered. You don't have to mention yourself by name.
Who sent the memo?
It was sent to us by Office of General Counsel.
Okay, yeah.
The same people who ended up investigating, spending your tax dollars investigating my podcast.
Wow. Well, but in a weird way, that's sort of like pledging on Patreon, right? Like, I'm going to spend my tax dollars. It's like paying, you know, my tax dollars for someone to listen, some more people to listen to your show.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not spending any government money making my show, but the government's spending money looking into it. Yeah. Okay.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims. Did you know that 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35? And once you've noticed that thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. So, why do guys turn to weird solutions or do nothing when they can turn to medicine and science? And that's where 4hims.com comes in. They are your one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and sexual wellness for men. I love 4hims.com. Here's what I like most about it. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits for stuff that, you know, frankly, you might be a little uncomfortable talking about. Here's what else I love. These are not snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements. These are prescription solutions backed by science. We on the show believe in science. It's very important to us that these are FDA-approved products and licensed medical providers. That's very important to us. Here's how it works. 4hims.com connects you to licensed medical professionals online, which could save you hours, and it's completely confidential and discreet. You answer a few quick questions, a medical professional will review, and if they determine it's right for you, they can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. And today, Hims is giving you their best offer yet. If you're not happy with your results after 90 days, Hims will give you a full refund. And right now, our listeners can get their very first visit absolutely free. Go to 4hims.com/OA. That's 4hims, FORHIMS.com/OA. Full refund of price paid available for the first 90-day supply. Refund requests must be made between 90 and 180 days after product shipment delivered. Prescription products require an online consultation with a medical professional who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. One more time, remember that is 4hims.com/OA.
So I get a phone call because, you know, like I said, another thing, too, I need to tell you is that a lot of times I would be we were doing a tour and there would be days when it would be during work hours that I would be either be traveling or whatever. And I always took leave, like my leave that I earned from working there for over a decade. And so I was either on leave or it was after hours. Those were few and far between, but I was on leave and I actually took after. Okay. Little timeline here. April of 2019, my two new bosses, because my old bosses had just retired, quote unquote retired, flew out across the country to San Diego from DC, spending your taxpayer money, flew across the country to tell me that my job was moving across the country. Now, this is this is an old trick. You might have heard Mick Mulvaney talk about it on August 6th. Washington Post, August 6th, 2019, dropped a story where he was recorded talking to a bunch of rich donors saying, it's really hard to fire federal government employees. So these liberals that we don't like, what we do is we move their job across the country and see they quit. Get it? Isn't that cool? High five. And so they flew out, tell me my job as the West Region TRICARE liaison was moving to the East Region. Now, there's two of me in the country. There's a West Region liaison and an East Region liaison. The East Region liaison is in Falls Church, D.C. Mm-hmm. West Region, and that's the TRICARE Regional Office for the East Region, for the Department of Defense. West Region liaison is at the San Diego TRICARE Regional Office for
somewhere
the West Region.
Somewhere in the West, you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. The reader will recall, Washington, D.C. is not in the West. So there's two of us, and we're at our respective offices. They say, it's imperative. You have to be face-to-face in Washington, D.C. to do this job. And I was like, really? Because you moved me and my job to San Diego because it was imperative that I be here. But okay, I can't move. And they knew this because a year earlier, I was offered the position of the guy who was firing me. I was offered that position and I turned it down because I couldn't move to D.C. So they knew I couldn't go. So part of restructuring, modernization, whatever catchphrase they were using, we're moving your West Region job to the East Region. Okay, cool. Who's going to watch the West Region? You are from the East. Okay, whatever. So, you know, I have PTSD, and this is going to be the third time the government has betrayed me. So I take 12 weeks off of my earned leave, right? I come back from those 12 weeks on August 6th. Which is the same day that Washington Post article drops about Mick Mulvaney and the jobs moving across the country thing. And I get a call. I have a call scheduled with my boss who would, I think it's going to be, welcome back. Here's what you missed and catch me up. But instead it was, this is a fact-finding investigation. You were required to answer all my questions. So I said, well, this sounds like I'm going to need a lawyer present on this call. And they're like, you aren't allowed to have a lawyer present. You must answer our questions.
Really? I'm sorry. I keep going now, but like, yeah, that's, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so now my heart is pounding. I'm caught. I've somehow slipped up. It's really easy to violate the Hatch Act, by the way. It's really easy to break any government rule. There's 8,000 pages of rules. You could have worn pink on Tuesdays instead of Wednesdays, and then you can't sit with us. I'm like, oh, all right, then. I'll answer your questions. They're like, all right, go to MuellerSheWrote.com. And I'm like, oh, like the color drains out of my skin. And they go, is that you? And I'm like, are you sure I can't have a lawyer? They're like, nope, you can't have a lawyer. I was like, yep, that's me. And they go, all right, go to this. They give me a long URL to type in to my browser. And it's a Twitter post.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of our fans sending in. It was a video, a little 1 minute video of me on stage in Minneapolis at the Parkway Theater, sold out house. This clip is me splitting the audience into three parts and leading everyone in a three-part harmony of Manafort is fucked, fucked, fucked. And by the end of fucked, like we're all singing this big, huge chord, everyone's on their feet, everyone's clapping and singing. And then I cut it off and then there's a standing ovation and the crowd goes wild. And I am...
I miss live shows.
I am simultaneously terrified. Because, you know, anyone who wants to work for the federal government is like, oh, shit, I hope I didn't break any rules, you know. But also that they took me to me leading a three-part harmony of the word fucked about Paul Manafort is just too goddamn hilarious. This is part of the investigation into my podcast.
You're like, I'm sorry, is my part-time job as a choral director incompatible with my job?
I'm just glad it wasn't, that they weren't holding against you, you know, some of the things I said during our Philadelphia live show, which, you know, would have been equally as incriminating.
Well, they had a whole list of tweets for me to look for. Uh-huh. Instead of just saying, you know, we want to know what's going on, they had to take me through this shadow play of...
Sure.
Pretend investigations. And then after the, you know, I filed all sorts of complaints, an EEO complaint, because I asked for, they said, look, I already told you 3 months ago to fire me because I'm not moving to DC. And they're like, well, you still work for us. And I'm like, all right, well, then I would like to request 100% telework. I can't be in the office. You fucking freak me out. You people freak me out. And they're like, no, you have to be in the office face to face. And I'm like, in San Diego, I have to be in the office face to face. Then why is my job moving to Washington, D.C.? So they denied my accommodation request for telework. And so I filed another complaint for discrimination, retaliation. And then they said, okay, you can have 100% telework. And I'm like, nah, bro, I'm going back on leave without pay. And because I'm out of earned leave at this point. So I'm like, I'm not working. You're not paying me. You fire me when you're fucking ready. And No, I'm not doing this. And
the show is going to be an editing challenge to get back to the clean iTunes podcast tag, but well, I'll do my best.
Can we get you to sing Clown Horn? Clown Horn.
I know.
Clown
yeah, that's what I'm really sad about. I don't know how to fix that. That's the one that's.
I think this is just going to have to be a not clean
right.
episode.
That's fine.
Or you can just beep the F at the beginning.
Ucked.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, there we go. All right, now I know what this episode is going to be called.
Yeah.
So they kept putting it off. This was, you know, I mean, this was August, and I'm trying to get. So I file all these EEO complaints, and they're, I don't know what they're doing, but I end up having an EEO investigation done. I get the EEO investigation report. It turns out Office of General Counsel was directing my supervisor to investigate me, and I don't know who tasked the Office of General Counsel to investigate me. So I filed a FOIA request and I got the emails and they're all redacted.
Hmm.
From redacted to Office of General Counsel. Office of General Counsel to redacted. So they didn't want me to know anything above Office of General Counsel. And I still don't know to this day. But what I was told was that, you know, the way they found out about what I was doing was through my coworker, my cohort in the East region liaison, just brought it up to our supervisor. And I'm like, yeah, that's not what happened. No. FOIA request. And of course, I hired a credible law firm to represent me in these, you know, the EEO and retaliation suits. And anyway, it took them from August 2019 to March 25th to finally remove me. And guess what? They did not fire me for not accepting a position in Washington, D.C. They fired me for being medically unfit.
while, you know, we would not want to violate your rights to confidentiality involving your medical condition, what on earth were they saying?
They were saying that because of my PTS, because I couldn't work face-to-face in the office because I had asked for a reasonable accommodation before they fired me, while I sat around and waited to be fired, they said I was medically unfit.
Doesn't that seem like they're confessing to a violation of the law? I mean, I'm no lawyer or anything, but...
Yes. Yes, it does.
Let me kind of bring it around full circle. When our friends over at CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, who have worked harder the past 4 years than in their entire lives, have documented 60 plus separate occasions in which Kellyanne Conway has violated the Hatch Act as a White House spokesperson. And when asked about that, Kellyanne Conway replied, "Oh, the Hatch Act. Let me know when the prison sentence starts." Right? The attitude that, I mean, in addition to
it's the being, party of law and order, everybody.
Yeah, but there are. I mean, you know, trying to steal man as best we can. A bunch of monsters. There certainly are long-standing statutes that have been on the books that are rarely, if ever, enforced. But it doesn't sound like that's the view of the Hatch Act from within the executive branch, from boots on the ground like you. Were Kellyanne Conway's comments like in line with how your average executive branch employee views this, or was that the privilege of somebody knowing that, you know, she was never going to be sanctioned by anybody for anything?
The latter, because we all, you know, us frontline career employees, career professionals, we take the Hatch Act extremely seriously, because if you violate it, you can be removed from your job. I mean, there's no real other teeth to it, but that's a pretty big consequence. And there have been a lot of people fired for violating the Hatch Act. And we have to take Hatch Act mandatory training every year. It's a big damn deal if you work, as is most secrecy and all that other stuff. You know, it's a very clandestine group of folks, and even if you're not working, you know, in OPSEC or you don't have clearances, it's still very, you are loyal to your agency. They are totally violating, shitting all over it. And in fact, that's part of my lawsuit, right? You although they didn't technically fire me for violating the Hatch Act, they investigated it, but they don't apply it equally, and that's a big no-no to the EEO, the Equal Employment Office.
Yeah.
Anybody who's been a manager in government knows that. You're like, I need to fire that person. Well, has anyone else done what that person did and you didn't punish them? Yeah. Well, then you can't. So it's a very serious matter. And you know, Mark Meadows coming out and saying, nobody outside of the Beltway cares about the Hatch Act. But even if he's wrong, he's inferring that people who work for the government fucking care about it. You know, care about it. It's a big deal. And we're all very, you know, we don't work for the government to get the money. We're not in it for the cash. We're in it because we believe in what we do. And so generally, you people who work in service of others and believe in what they do and believe in their work and make crap money for it are ethical people.
I couldn't add anything to that. So I just want to thank you for getting on and sharing your story and sharing your identity. Thomas, I don't know if you had any other questions.
No, I mean, I think it's case closed. I mean, like, the Hatch Act somehow doesn't matter when the Secretary of State, you know, makes a political speech for the president, but when a podcaster criticizes Trump, then all of a sudden it's a big deal. I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And you also have to remember, I was having Andy McCabe on the show. Like, I was propping up the intelligence community when Trump wanted to tear it down. I think that is probably why I was considered an enemy or on the enemies list. But yeah. I will give you a piece of good news. I battled for my severance and I got that, but I am still working on a wrongful termination hearing. Not lawsuit yet. We're still in the hearing phase, where hopefully somebody at the VA will make a decision. If they don't decide my way, then Then, Andrew, you and I should have a chat.
We will.
Are you sure you don't want me to handle the lawsuit? Okay. Yeah, no, that's fine. Go ahead, Andrew. I'm okay
Thomas,
at the bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Thomas has a really good chance
I'll get
of getting
like
the top
55% of your lawsuit filed correctly.
But I tell you what, I'm very, very happy and very excited to be freed up now to campaign for Joe and Kamala. And I've actually been recruited and added to the DNC war room, and I've been working hard on their behalf. And if anyone, and I'm allowed to say this now, and it's like free at last, if you can donate anything to Joe and Kamala, any amount helps, please do it.
Hear, hear.
Well, now I can say Allison Gill. Thanks so much for joining us in your fully named capacity here. Again, people should check out Mueller, She Wrote and The Daily Beans. And anything else we want to throw out there?
Yeah, follow me on my personal account now, at Allison Gill. A-L-L-I-S-O-N-G-I-L-L. And thanks for listening.
Thanks as always for coming on the show.
You guys are awesome. I appreciate everything that you do. Keep it up.
Yeah, you too.
Down. 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 All right. Thanks again to, now we can say Allison Gill. No more no more initials there. Thanks again.
It'll always be AG to me.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, AG. either way, thanks again. And Andrew, I know you wanted to give a little bit of a spiel here on something.
Yeah, you and I are working on a bonus episode because so many people have written to us and said they went to law school from listening to Opening Arguments, which, you know, don't remember that when you're paying back your student loans in a couple of years. It was not our fault.
Hey, we tried our best. I know you directed people on what to do about that.
So people have gone to law school, have said that the show's inspired them. Please do keep sharing those stories with us. Something that's going around that was in the Opening Arguments community on Facebook, schools are starting up, and whether they're starting up, you know, socially distant, semi in person or all online, a lot of people are starting law school for the first time, and wondered, you know, kind of what our thoughts were about it. We're a little bit scared, a little bit overwhelmed. So we are going to do an episode on what to do if you're in law school.
What to expect when you're expecting.
What to expect when you're expecting in law school. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're way out of time here. And, you know, it was foolhardy of me to think we could even talk about this. The one piece of advice that I want you to remember if you're a law student right now, and particularly if you're first year and you're overwhelmed in the first week, first couple of days, I want you to think about law school as if it is a foreign language immersion course that runs for 3 years, because in a great many ways, it is. You are dropped into this strange new world in which the vocabulary is insane. And I don't just mean like the Latin that I can never remember and you're not going to have to remember either. But I mean like just the standard, right? Like what is the difference between, you know, what is all of our vocabulary, or, you know, what is injunctive relief, you know, versus a temporary restraining order? You know, what does it mean to prosecute versus to persecute, right? Like it all sorts of things that you're 90% sure you knew as a real person are all going to seem crazy now that you're, you know, in law school. And it's worse in the first couple of weeks. And the reason why, and I want you to know it gets better. The reason is that most law school classes use a casebook method, and the casebooks, for some utterly insane reason, are arranged chronologically. Hmm. Now, sometimes I get that, right? Like it's important, you know, when we emphasize on the show, like, yeah, this principle has been around since 13th century Saxony. Okay, I get that. But what it means is if you're fresh out of college, right, or, you know, fresh off, you're a first-year law student. You don't know any law. That's why you were there. And when the first thing they give you to read is some English case from 1685, you're like, all right, stop the ride. I want to get off. Right?
Like, stop the carriage.
Yeah, I get it. Right. And notwithstanding my all-time personal favorite human being, Elizabeth Warren, and her trap of what's a sumpsit that we've talked about.
Like, I know I'll never fall for that one after hearing that story 70 times on the show, but it's a good story.
But let me say, like, it's a good story, but it's the wrong lesson, right? Like, when you're reading, don't worry about what a sumpsit, right? Like, okay, if Liz Warren is your professor, maybe worry about that. But like, seriously, like, get it wrong. Because what happens is you read the case in context and you don't stop to look up every stupid 18th century word. You're just like, yeah, okay, it's an action in a sumpsit. Well, what does that mean? I think they want to get the money back, right? And so could you define it with dictionary precision? No, but you don't have to. So yeah. This is what I would say. The earlier cases are very, very hard to read. And so much of this is just about like, getting you familiar with the process of reading cases, and that will come at, you know, with time in law school. So read it, absorb, you know, don't stop, don't define every word, don't go looking up a sumpsit, just figure out the gist of what this case is about and ask yourself, like, yeah, why did they assign me this case? Like, what did they want me to learn from this case? And you'll do fine. And we're going to do super deep dive on,
yep.
on
and
all
that,
of this.
Everybody, was what Andrew thinks 60 seconds is.
59.60. There we go.
Time.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our top patrons at patreon.com/law, enjoying all the perks, the stuff we already did the sell. We won't do it again. But go check it out. patreon.com/law. Here's our top patrons. At Casa Agria is the best brewery. At Emperor's Brewery is a close second. Stoic Paralegal. Re-elect Senator Doug Jones. The Great Dooku Tree. Thomas Kleberg. Bradford Keedy. Brad Fraud Keedy. Mary Perez. Amicus Flinch. Dan from Deerfield. I won't tell another dicta joke until Trump is out of office. Buddy Geyerson. I now possess that which you most fear. You'll do my bidding or taste my wrath. Ann Schmeckel. Oh, Clownhorn, I'm actually starting law school. Yeah, there you go. Well, you're one of the listeners that Andrew had in mind here. Maybe if Trump shined some UV light into the ballot drop boxes or injected some bleach into them. Two fabulous lesbians who just got married. Congratulations yet again. Stop getting married, though. I feel like, you know, it's been like three or four times. William Drew Collins, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours is not going to give Steve Bannon a refund on that grappa tour he's not going to be able to make now. Greg Kreimer, The Pauly Shore Experience, Register Every Person You Know to Vote, Imagine the G. Carlin 2020 album, Tell the Jeter Gift Basket Story. Well, maybe Andrew already did last night. We don't know now, but in your timeline, maybe it already happened. I Guess Murder Hornets were just a filler episode. You know, if I had to guess, Andrew, I would imagine that one T. Gomes, you know, is going to put that in, use her first question privileges to ask about the Jeter gift basket story. But I don't know. That's just a prediction. Cheeky Breaky, the article I wrote and announced here on Trump's narcissism got published by the folks at the Midas Touch. Thank you. 2020 has been the most exhausting decade. Mike Hall, sigh, editing this name is a pain in the ass and my best gags keep getting lost. Patreon, get with the program. Fly Like a Hot Dog, Freedom Eagle. Angry Macface, say it with me, Amicus. Ugh. Matthew McConaughey, portraying Matthew McConaughey. Long time ago, me and my brother Kyle here, we was hitchhiking down a long and lonesome road. Center, Black Trans Sex Workers.
Are they telling a story in the...
One of my favorite songs. It's a tribute from the Tenacious D album. And Dave Grohl is amazing as the devil. That music video is perfect. It's a perfect creation of art. And everybody should watch it.
I wonder if
even you would like it. Yeah, yeah. No, it's and it's sort of Tenacious D in general. There's a lot of homage to 80s stuff, you know.
Yeah,
there's a lot
yeah,
of
that's
stuff.
Right.
Yeah, so go watch that. It's the best. Stop. Ask a question a president of Finland would ask. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Postal Police, stamping out crimes since 1775. That's awesome. I love that one. Voterly, if you can, this episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. A crime that is sufficiently complex is practically legal. Or, by the way, things really, 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 really simple, like violating the Hatch Act repeatedly. Doesn't have to be complex. Maybe Patreon will save this name change. Change my Patreon name so that I don't jump every time you read it. Bar question. A televangelist is thinking about Alanis Morissette and walking around naked in his living room when the police... And then it cuts off. Our Spanish football club lawyers, experts in real property. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. Meg Steve King, an author again. Murray Gregerson. Andrew is my favorite undeclared congressional candidate. Thomas is a close second. We better start declaring. It's coming up. Don't have a cow, Naomi Rao. Just let Flynn go to prison. -infinity. Ian Buckley, going out to buy a whole library of stamps. Not that, Chris Wallace. Putting a pin in this patron name for later. Still funny. Jake Braun, give to modestneeds.org, give to modestneeds.org. Christopher Brown, I'm too sexy to vote Trump. Too sexy to vote Trump. Trump needs to be reimpeached. I'm a lawyer. You know what I mean when I... That cuts off. Lawful Copter says, of course Trump isn't throwing out the Yankees' first pitch. He's dropped the ball on literally everything else. Kylo V. U.S. is really about Scalia growing his own weed. Okay. The wheels of justice turn faster than the speed I change my Patreon name. The U.S. is the best plague country. Brazil is a close second. Oh my God, isn't that the truth? Various goat noises. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Oh, wow, a little cooperation there. Collusion. Let me drink lots of water. I like peeing totally clear. It's a good one. I like it.
That is an excellent one.
Nice. Andrew Seidel's butt says COVID conspiracists are strange bedfellows for rationalists. Huh. Zirkle, podcasters' lives matter too. I'm pledging $250 a month for Patreon creators. Just don't tell my wife. Odin wants the Twitter character limit enforced on T3BE and for you to vote for Joe. I want more briefs. Polly Hernandez, the previous patron name is true. The next patron name is false. This is a great week for those who, like me, who have a fetish for watching Jerry Falwell get screwed. Emily Rainbow Spence, stocking up on lung injectable bleach. Internet Explorer votes for Boston Live Show. Terry Cannon, Jason Copas, punching fascists is not enough. Get into good trouble. Hotspear, just realized it's Thursday again and forgot to change my Patreon name. What's the character limit again? Take donation advice from a podcast, FFRF, EFF, ACLU, Modest Needs, and our damn Patreon. Your turn, Andrew.
A big thank you to I've Got a Fever and the Only Prescription is More Triangle. That's amazing. Nate Trex, Darth Mandy Pants, Make America Great Again. V. Frank, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Save the USPS. They are essential for small businesses and our democracy. I can't get more behind them than us. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Kratch, J. Cheever, Loophole, Diogenes the Cynic was right. Jeff Gelback. Happy birthday to my sweetest honey bunny, Linda Jenkins. Yeah, happy birthday, Linda. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, civilpoliticsradio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. John Bilderback, who is the cocaine supplier at the RNC? They should have cut Junior off. If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times, keeping this name for the next 1,998 episodes. I'm still going to laugh. Oh,
they fixed it. Okay,
yeah, good. Philip Kaiser, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, Eric Alsman, I like traffic lights. Stop equivocating. They're not the same. Vote Biden. All right. I thought they were going for the I like traffic lights from Monty Python at the beginning. Anyway, baseball law states 2020 doesn't count. Alexa, remind me to send Karen Pence a sympathy card after the debate. Stop. Throw the grenade like a lawyer would throw.
Still funny.
Absion, Therese Chan, Payne's Trumpet, Trambolus, La Machine Infernal, The Wandering Gambler, Akatarawa, Japan. I say this at least twice a week. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with the UW nurses and their union. Guy Chapman, Death Escrow Karaoke, only songs by dead artists. Join your labor union, together we bargain, alone we beg. Wait, wrong list. Those are the protesters outside the RNC. James K, ah, gravity, thou art a heartless bitch. Ah, breath. Ah. Chad T, Anonymous, Siege Megatron's overly elastic lip animations. Hope you are all safe and well. Have a good week. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Impeach Thomas's Penguin, closing concessions. Airbud 69, the giving retriever. Maybe the real Conrad Michaels is the friends we made along the way. Liz literally just Googled define fun for a contract weeks. I I love that Liz is enjoying her best legal life ever as in-house counsel. Derek, Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwalt. History is made by those who show up, vote, and if you can, donate and volunteer for Biden. Matamela Ramaphosa. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. My superpower is knowing the difference between Bill Pullman and Bill Paxton. That is outstanding.
That's I know the difference.
Yeah, well, I don't. Rhonda 2020, because WTF not. I've donated more to Biden than any other candidate combined ever, and I don't even like him. Malika Chandler, tricicular manslaughter, soggy pants, Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Sakashite Fukusumi, the only difference between Trump and Lukashenko is that pig farming is a noble profession. Don't take legal advice from Laserbeam Monstrosity Attorney at Law. Heather Loveridge, David in Brooklyn, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Ally, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Teresa Gomez. I'm shocked. That's usually a joke name right there. Mitchell, no commute, so behind on podcasts. Voting is like driving. To go forward, choose D. To go backwards, choose R. That's clever. I never saw that before. Sam Buck, Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. I agree with that 100%. And of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
It is time for T3BE answer time. This was a very specialized one. I don't know what happened here.
So this was a question about the service of discovery. And so the question asked, the attorney for the plaintiff in an action filed in federal district court served the defendant with the summons, right? That is the notice that you are formally being served with the complaint and that you have to respond, the complaint itself, and a whole bunch of interrogatories asking questions about the defendant's contentions in the case, said defense counsel is going to be able to move for protective order. But why? Like, why is it inappropriate to do that? And I want to tell you something interesting here. This process is not inappropriate in many states, right? It's not inappropriate at Maryland. You can serve, you can serve the complaint and serve a whole bunch of interrogatories along with the complaint in terms
now
of
I'm even more confused.
Yeah.
That's probably really far away from this one.
So it's not appropriate in the federal system because of the federal rules of civil procedure, because the federal system says, no, we are not going to have, it's not going to be, litigation in federal court is not going to be like your free for all of you peons down in state court. We're going to do this in an orderly process. Right? And so the question is, first, you narrowed it down to B and C, eliminating A. Interrogatories are proper only to discover facts, not contentions. That's not true. In fact, there's an entire set of interrogatories that are called contention interrogatories. And so it is perfectly fine to say, please describe if you contend, right? So I'll give you an example of one that I use all the time, right? I am a defense counsel and I will say, you've sued us for X. Please describe if you contend that we owe you anything else in connection with any other matter, right? So that then puts the onus on the other side to say either, yes, we do think you also owe us in X, Y, or no, yeah, no, we don't. This is it. This is all we're saying you owe us, right? So it enables us to kind of focus down.
But what would be the interrogatory? Oh, give me an example, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. When the plaintiff in a federal court serves the defendant with a summons, like what's an interrogatory they're going to ask about a contention?
Put the shoe on the other foot, right? If you were the plaintiff and it's a civil lawsuit, you might say, state the bases of any affirmative defenses that you might offer in this litigation, right? So
really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that's how anything worked.
Yeah. So you can say like, you answered the complaint and said that, you know, you might raise the affirmative defense of unclean hands, right? That is, the plaintiff did bad stuff. And so even if you owe the plaintiff money, you don't owe this plaintiff any money because they used bad stuff in getting there, right? 100% of the time, I would say, tell me the bad stuff you think my client did.
I just thought this happened in the courtroom. So yeah. This makes law shows even worse, essentially.
Now, I should say many, many lawyers think contention interrogatories are useless. I don't think that, right? But it is certainly the case that you tend to get very...
You tend to get evasive answers. Wouldn't you want to pull your cards a little close to your... vest or chest? I never know which one.
Yeah, you do, but the flip side of that is I'm going to ask your witnesses their theory of the case anyway, right? Like when you put on, you know, fact witnesses, your company CEO, I'm going to say, you know, Mr. Smith, how much money do you think my client owes your company? And then if you can't tell me a precise number, then you know, I'm going to say, oh, really? So why?
Mr. What Smith, would you- I'm confused.
I'm confused. Yeah. Right. Then if you give me a precise number, I'm going to say, oh, okay. So my client, owes your company $10 million. Let's talk about how that number was calculated. Hmm. Right. And I'm going to just ask you open-ended questions and write it down on my little notepad until we get to $10 million. And so I'm going to do that in our deposition anyway. So I don't think it's a big deal knowing that I'm going to prep my witness to say that, to write it out in the answer to an interrogatory. Again, different lawyers disagree over that. But so that is, you said you excluded A, good exclusion. Okay. You may discover contentions. You also excluded D, the interrogatories exceed the number permitted without permission. That was a good guess because Rule 33 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure allow you to serve up to 25 interrogatories without leave of court.
Got lucky there.
So the fact that it was 25 was good. An aspect that is you would think would be debated more than it is that, you know, technically you can count subparts as separate interrogatories.
I'm sure I imagine one P. Andrew Torres really sneaking in the sub interrogatory. He's like, I have 60 seconds worth of interrogatories for you here.
Perhaps. So that leaves B, may not be served until the answer is filed, or C, may not be served until the parties have conferred to arrange for initial disclosures and prepare a discovery plan. You went with B. It is, unfortunately, C.
Gosh, dang it!
It was super duper close.
So close again!
And the reason is, so think about this. The reason is that the obligation to answer comes before the court is going to set at a discovery conference, right? Mm. So in other words, you and the obligation to answer depends upon whether the party is in state or out of state, but you answer first, then the court sets a scheduling conference. And then after that scheduling conference, that scheduling conference will say, here's when we think the trial date is going to be, here's when discovery will be concluded, here's when expert discovery will be concluded, right? It's the parties kind of get together and figure out how long the trial is going to take. That comes after the answer, and in the federal system, you know, we sort of tried to have this more civilized model of, you know, it's not just a free for all. You can't get it in as soon as you want. So that's a later occurrence. And that's why that is the right. I mean, it's the right answer because the rules say so, but that's why the rules say so.
Yeah.
Sometimes you eat the bar and sometimes the bar while he eats you.
That's some kind of Eastern thing.
So close. I'm getting hammered by this thing lately. It's just one after the next. I mean,
I know.
My second chance law firm still going strong though.
Would hire you.
Quite the record. Yeah.
Most of the time, you'll get one of the top two answers. So
also, I could just look it up. But yeah, if I were a real law firm, why don't we see who the real winner is for this week's T3BE?
Well, Thomas, I'm going to break my own rule. This week's winner is AJ Hernandez, a lawyer on Twitter, who writes, "It's C, but since I get no fame and fortune for knowing Rule 26D, here is my argument for why @SeriousPod, that's you, Thomas, is still technically right. B, the rules require defendants to answer before they would have to confer. So in that respect, B is true. I'll bill you later. AJ, that was incredibly clever, and I'm going to break the rule just to allow you to win on that one. Everyone, give him a follow. That is at AJ Hernandez Esquire, at AJHERNANDEZESQ on Twitter. And AJ, congratulations for being the most unlikely of this week's winners.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We will see you for another Rapid Response Friday. As always, see you then.
Bye-bye.
He's not even a lawyer and he's kicking your ass.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media LLC. All rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.